So as David approached death, it seemed like there would be a succession crisis whenever he happened to die. There were two contenders for the throne. There was Adonijah, widely viewed as the heir apparent, and there was Solomon, the second son of Bathsheba and David, who we read about last week. Ultimately, it was Bathsheba's influence that had Solomon declared as the rightful heir. And though there's a small bit of trouble when Solomon takes the throne, he's quickly and widely accepted as king. And so we get the beginning of the reign of Solomon the Wise. Solomon, who went to offer sacrifices to God and was asked by God what he should receive. Solomon asked for a discerning or an understanding mind. Well, there's a translation to keep in mind here. Solomon, according to the NRSV translation and the NIV translation, asked for an understanding mind that he might govern God's people. But a better translation might have been that he wanted an understanding mind so he could judge God's people. Solomon's response of wanting wisdom deeply affects God, and the request is granted. What follows is the story of Solomon and the two women who are arguing over who is the true mother of a child. But it gives Solomon a chance to showcase his newfound wisdom. He hears the complaints of both women and makes his pronouncement, "Let the baby be cut in half." When one woman protests, willingly giving up her half, he reasons that she must be the true mother. Probably my favorite commentary on this, and we'll call it a commentary on Solomon in general, and this story in particular, comes from Joseph Heller's book, God Knows. Has anyone read God Knows? No one. Has anyone read Catch 22? Okay, that Joseph Heller. It's David recounting his life, asking questions, lamenting, ranting. It's a very funny book, as Joseph Heller is wont to be. But I love the way that David reflects on this story. And he says, quote, "I'll let you in on a secret about my son Solomon. He was dead serious when he proposed cutting the baby in half, that putz. I swear to God that dumb blank was trying to be fair, not shrewd." This is a book that doesn't hold Solomon in high regard. All the wisdom writings that we credit to Solomon, according to David, all the best lines anyway, he took from his father and simply got the credit because he wrote them down. And there's something to this. Because for all of his wisdom, Solomon was a great fool. Solomon, so wise in his judgments over the people he ruled, was far less wise in his own life. He lived extravagantly. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He brought in tremendous wealth, and he raised massive armies of horses and chariots. And after he built the temple, he went on to many other massive construction projects. He began worshiping other gods, and this set the God of Israel off. So opulent was his life, so much stress did his works put on the people, that it led to the split of the kingdom. This is where that earlier translation comes into play. Solomon was really good at judging others, but in many ways, he was terrible at governing. After his death, 10 tribes broke away and became the northern kingdom of Israel because they were so tired of living under the burdens Solomon had placed on them, and they didn't see much hope in his son. All that remained loyal was the smaller kingdom of Judah in the south, and it was the end of the united kingdom of Israel. Solomon was blind to his own compulsions. He was blind to his own needs. He was blind to his own desires, to his own habits, to his own sins. Sure, he was great at figuring everything else out, great at solving everyone else's problems, but his own led to his downfall and the downfall of the united monarchy. And so we have to ask ourselves, how wise was Solomon actually? And we also have to ask, aren't we all a bit like this? Don't all of us have a lot of answers for everyone else? but in trying to discern our own lives, our own compulsions, our own character, well, that's where we run into trouble. Jesus comments on this in Matthew 7. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own? How can you say to your brother, let me take that speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a great plank in your own eye? You hypocrite! First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly enough to remove the speck from your brother's eye. This seems to be the human condition. To look at the world around us and to immediately know what the problems are out there and how to fix them. But never being aware of who we ourselves are, how we act, what we do. I've been at the receiving end of that, and honestly, I've been at the giving end of that. No one is innocent. We do it as individuals, we do it as organizations, we do it as nations, we do it as a species. We cast our judgments and our pronouncements wide, satisfied that if only everyone would listen to us, everything would be fine. But this is the original sin. This is the sin of knowledge of good and evil, because while we are judging, we are never looking inside. And we see the ramifications of this all over. We've seen them this past week in three different instances of hate in the U.S. that made the news. There was the attempted attack on a black community church that ended with the deaths of two black individuals at a nearby store. There was the pipe bomb scare. There was the attack on the synagogue. These killers or attempted killers looked out. They saw a problem. But did they ever look inward and see what they were doing? I like what Nietzsche wrote. Convictions are more dangerous enemies of truth than lies. We have our convictions and we use them to look at the rest of the world. But when we look at the rest of the world, we become blinded to ourselves. Now, granted, those other examples are extreme, but we all do it to a degree. The elephant and the pig in Mr. Dizzy's world are so set in how right they are, in how intelligent they are, that they are ready to judge the world around them. They never see that they are ultimately just a couple of jerks. Solomon is so grounded in how wise he is that he tears the kingdom apart because his wisdom is never directed at himself. And to be honest, I'm not even sure how wise his decision with the two women was. Maybe he should have asked his mother what it's like to lose a child before delighting in his own understanding of the situation. When the oracle at Delphi pronounced Socrates the wisest man in the world, Socrates disagreed. He knew that he knew nothing, and he set about to prove it. He spoke to the smartest people in all of Athens, but after doing that, it wasn't long before he realized that nobody really knows much. But we sure all think we do. And at that point, he understood the Delphic Oracle's proclamation. He is wisest who knows he knows nothing. I think this is why Jesus so often holds up the outcasts of society. Because very often it's the outcasts who are away from all the trappings of success who perhaps have an easier time saying, well, maybe I don't know as much as I want to. There's those of us grounded in the trappings of success and all the things that middle-class privilege offers us. Well, we can get pretty self-satisfied. Pretty easy to point the finger and tell other people what to do. Solomon, all of us, in fact, I think would be wise to heed this story of Socrates. And so here we are at our 25th anniversary in this building. And 25 years is a good amount of time to catch our breath and to look at ourselves and to ask some big questions. Not to ask, what do we know? but rather to ask, well, what do we think we know? And then really challenge ourselves on those. Thanks be to God. Amen.